And tonight on Coast to Coast, we're going to talk about the Weiser book of the fantastic and the forgotten. Strange mysteries, bizarre fictional stories. Judica Ellis with us. We'll also get into witchcraft later on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. She's back. Judica Ellis has been a student of the magical arts since she was a child. Her interests include tarot, the runes, and other forms of divination, astrology, spell casting, traditional healing, spirituality, and so many more things. And we're going to be talking about witchcraft and also her latest work, The Weiser Book of the Fantastic and Forgotten. Judica, welcome back.
Thank you, George. I'm happy to be here.
I would guess that the name The Weiser Book, spelled W-E-I-S-E-R, is that because of Samuel Weiser, yeah. The publisher?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Weiser Books.
I loved that company when
yeah,
I was younger.
Yeah, me too.
They had everything you needed, astral projection, witchcraft, you name it, they had it.
Yeah, yeah. And I remember the store in New York City, which no longer exists, way back when.
When did he start out, do you know?
I think in like the 1920s. It starts off as a stall on the Lower East Side, and Samuel Weiser discovered that people were interested in strange books, interesting esoteric books. They were willing to pay for them. And he went from being a general, you know, just a general bookstall into one of the first specialized esoteric bookstores in the world, especially in the U.S.
My webmaster, who's on top of everything, said it was 1926 he started off. And you're right. It's right there on New York Row somewhere on one of those streets.
Yeah.
And people just love that. Well, you know, they were into Charles Fort and all these weird things. We didn't have television in those days.
Yeah.
So the entertainment was books and magazines and stories. And they just ate this stuff up, didn't they?
Yeah. And then they began publishing it, you know, from just selling old books that they found, you know, or that people were trying to get rid of. They discovered they could actually meet the demand themselves, and, you know, here we are.
Here we are indeed.
Later.
Well, sorry, tell us a little bit about the Book of the Fantastic and the Forgotten.
The Fantastic and the Forgotten is a bit of a departure for me because, you know, up until now I've specialized in nonfiction, and it's the second in a series. Last year there was The Weiser Book of the Horror and the Occult, which was curated by Lon Milo Ducat, who is a great writer, and so I had some big footsteps to step into, and it is a selection, an anthology of vintage weird fiction, esoteric fiction. So it's a lot of fun. Fantastic and Forgotten, fantastic not just because they're good stories, which they are.
Oh, they are, yeah.
But also in the old-fashioned sense of the word, fantastic is something that stretched belief, something that pushed that envelope. And forgotten because although not all of the stories are forgotten, there's a couple in there that maybe are not. These are stories that have just, you know, I mean, we have TV now and we have movies and the internet.
Zombies.
And so a lot of these stories have been left behind. You know, someone like Marie Corelli, who was Queen Victoria's favorite author, she outsold Arthur Conan Doyle in her day.
Wow.
And you know, now, how many people recall Marie Corelli? So I'm hoping to, you know.
How did you find the stories? How did you edit them down?
Well, some of them I went looking for. Some of them, Marie Corelli, I read a reincarnation romance that she wrote as a child. We just have, you know, my parents had it on the shelves. And it totally hooked me in. To this day, I love a reincarnation love story. And some of them, I was looking for interesting esoteric fiction, stories that still held up, that would hold up for modern readers, and also that, you know, you have to kind of wade through the stuff because some of these stories are very much a product of their time, and not the stories that I included. I wanted to make sure the stories I included were inclusive and people enjoyed and were not, you know, didn't reflect the negative attitudes that people might have had at the turn of the century. That would be the 20th century, not the 21st century. So that took a little bit of sifting, but I hope that I did a good job.
So would you call these stories compilations?
Yeah, well, it's a compilation of, I believe, 13 stories. Is it 13? I think so. Maybe more. I don't even remember.
I think there are more.
It might be 18. I'm working on another one now, and so I have the books conflated in my head. But it's a compilation of stories. I tried to vary them. We've got some ghost stories, got a couple vampire stories.
What are some of your favorites?
I really do like the Marie Corelli story, which is the lady with the carnations, which is a ghost story. I love, there's the Hans Heinz Ewer story, The Spider, which is...
Tell us that one. Can you?
Oh, I can tell you. I mean, it's a strange story. Hans Heinz Ewers was known as the German Edgar Allan Poe, and...
Clever and creative.
He translated Edgar Allan Poe into German and specialized in sort of decadent supernatural tales. In this story, there is an apartment, and on several consecutive Fridays, several people in that apartment who don't know each other, have nothing to do with each other, have killed themselves in exactly the same way, the same time. And what is the connection?
Now, when you say the same time, they're in that apartment together?
No, I mean...
Same time, different days.
So on consecutive Fridays...
How weird.
Yeah, it is a weird
Were they tenants or guests?
They are. It is a rooming house.
A rooming house.
And so these men have gone, and they're staying in the room, and out of the blue, they're just discovered having hung themselves.
See, what I would have thought, being the investigator I am, somebody's murdered them. The same person.
And that is the story, exactly, because someone goes to investigate. And we have his diary of the investigation and what happens to him. And I don't want to give away the end of the story, but it is, I found it a little chilling.
Well, the macabre part of all of these stories, and many of them have this, again, intrigued a lot of people.
Yes.
How much of it dealt with the supernatural?
In this, my collection, all of it, all the stories in one way or another deal with the supernatural quite a bit at that time. And of course, you know, there was no TV, and there weren't as many distractions as we have now. And so there was much more short fiction. There were a lot of magazines and journals that would feature short fiction. And so there's tons of it, and you can find all kinds. You can find animal stories and love stories, but quite a bit. And I think the stories that hold up the best are devoted to the supernatural, or at least tangentially.
Are they all weird?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, they are, in every sense of that word.
The strange, Judica, really gets to people,
yeah,
doesn't it?
I like these stories because they're thought-provoking. They're not simple. They're complex stories.
They weave
themselves. They weave that touch on the supernatural in very profound ways. They're not just, you know, superficial, oh, there's like a ghost in the corner, and then we move on to something else. They actually... The gist of the stories are about the nature of the relationship between the living and the dead, between the effect that different types of phenomena can have on the living. And because it's fiction, it is just very thought-provoking. They make us think, are these things possible? Could these things happen? And, you know, there's a lot of food for thought here.
Now, are the stories based on events that have really happened, or have they been fictionalized on events?
Hard to say. hard to say. I think some of them are based on
rumors, myths.
Well, you know, I'm thinking there's a story by Algernon Blackwood in the collection called The Woman's Ghost Story. And it is a woman recounting her ghost hunting expedition. And the tone of the story and the details of the story strike me as being based on experience. How much of it was fictionalized, how much of it, you know, was made up to, you know, because these stories are also entertaining.
Right.
But Algernon Blackwood was an expert on the supernatural, and he had occult interests. And when you read the story, you can tell that he knows a little something about ghost hunting from, I think, personal experience.
When you look back at the time period, let's say, of the 1800s, they really took this stuff seriously.
Yeah.
They didn't have the kind of equipment we have today.
Right.
They didn't have EVPs. But they really took, you know, the subject matter of seances and everything else really serious. And, and in those days, you had some people who were just truly experts in those fields, didn't you?
Oh, I think so. I think so. And this is the beginning of the ghost hunting societies. And, you know, it coincides with the rise of spiritualism. And I think it was something that was very much on people's minds. I suspect they would have been very happy to have the equipment we have now. I think, you know, people don't realize how interested in the supernatural an author like Charles Dickens was.
Did you come across any old stories about extraterrestrials or UFOs? Did they ever go that way, or was it more ghostly?
More ghostly, but I think that's because that's before airplane travel.
Yeah.
So I don't.
And before Roswell.
Yeah, I don't think they were thinking in that context. There is a fairy story in here, The Twisting of the Rope by W.B. Yeats, and by fairy I mean the fierce fairies of Ireland.
The mean ones.
Who are feared. Not, you know, the cute little
Little Tinkerbells.
Because a lot of people see similarities between extraterrestrials and old fairy stories. You know, if you look at the old accounts of fairies, there are abductions. There are abductions. Sometimes they return people. When they return people, sometimes there's memory loss or time loss. Maybe they're not exactly the same when they come back. There are theories that because it's pre-flight, you know, it's pre-airplane, that people weren't, you know, it's possible these fairies may have been extraterrestrials. We just weren't comprehending the flight aspect.
Have you ever seen that photo of the Cottingley fairies?
Yeah, I saw the movie, too. I really liked it.
What do you think of that?
I don't know. I reserve judgment. I don't know. I know, you know, allegedly they've been debunked, but I've also heard the debunking was debunked. Very similar to the Fox sisters, where one of the Fox sisters, I mean, and of course the Fox sisters, for people who are unfamiliar, the Rochester rappers, were the first famous spiritualists, the first, they were sisters who made contact with the dead through tapping and rapping. And years later, one of the sisters, you know, claimed they faked it all, although she was never able to reproduce the faking on demand. And then later she denied that she faked it. And I think people believe what they want to, you know, I think people who were convinced it was fake believed it when she said that they had faked it. People who were convinced that it wasn't fake, you know, believed it when she recanted that confession. You know, I try to keep an open mind.
They were into Dracula a lot in those days too, weren't they?
Yes, yes, yes. Well, Dracula is really, Dracula changes the whole genre of the vampire.
Well, he sure does.
Yeah. You know, in my family, you know, my parents are from Hungary. My family is like from the heartland of old school folkloric vampires. And the vampires of Central Europe and the Balkans.
They were ugly.
Yeah. I mean, they're not.
They weren't romantic like they are now.
They bring disease. You know, they're clearly dead. They bring disease. They bring the plague.
They're mean.
They're mean. They don't necessarily suck your blood. They sap your life force instead. And Bram Stoker just transformed that. So, you know, now we have sexy vampires. You know, and Sheridan Le Fanu, who wrote Carmilla, you know, also another sexy vampire. But this is the period where, and of course, you know, Bram Stoker never went to Transylvania. He got all of that for books.
Yeah.
And, but, you know, he writes so wonderfully that you feel as if he had been there and we've been there. But he totally, totally took this, you know, basically an ugly phenomenon and transformed it into something so elegant and graceful that, you know, now we have all these movies and, you know, Angel and Buffy and Twilight and, you know, I don't know that we would have any of that without Bram. And there's one of his stories in the Weiserfield Guide to, The Weiser Book of the Fantastic and the Forgotten. It's a chapter that after he died, his widow, Florence, decided to publish some, I think she needed the funds, and she published some of his work posthumously. And one of the things she published was a story called Dracula's Guest, which apparently was a chapter that had been removed from the Dracula, the novel, but it stands alone. You know, if you are one of the few people on Earth who have never read Dracula, never seen any of the movies, never seen, you know, the Simpsons parody, you could still read the story and enjoy it.
Anne Rice, of course, has done a pretty good job keeping that Dracula genre going, too, hasn't she?
Yeah, Lesta, all the vampires.
Another story. Give us one more story before the break, can you?
Oh, well, we've got actually two Lovecraft stories in here, and Lovecraft is so fascinating. There's the horror in Martin's Beach and Dagon, and Lovecraft is so fascinating because even now, years after his death, people fight as to whether these were based on, you know, was he secretly a shaman? Was he secretly an occultist? He claimed to be a materialist. He claimed, you know, he claimed that it was just fiction for him. He liked to tell a good story. He didn't believe in any of it. But he was inspired by dreams. And so people argue about that. And I find these passionate arguments to be very interesting. And the stories are good, too.
They're great stories. I want to talk about witchcraft because you did write a book called The Encyclopedia of Witchcraft. And a lot of people are talking about witches these days as well. Good ones, bad ones, those that, you know, cast spells and curses on people and things like that. Judica, if people want your book, where do they find it and what's your website?
Oh, wherever fine books are sold. It's not hard to find. Website is myname.com, JUDIKAILLES.com.
What keeps driving you in this genre? You love it.
I do.
How come?
I never get bored with it. Every day I learn something new.
And frightening. I'm going to bite you. All right, Judica, stay with us. We're going to come back in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. We're going to talk a little bit about witches and spells and curses. And the next hour, it's your turn. You make the call. You know, it's so weird about the internet. I had that story earlier with Bev Harris about Hillary's New York house raided by the feds. It's all over the internet. It's all over the internet. Just Google it. But I can't find any source that says it really happened. It's weird. She hasn't heard about it either. I didn't even hear about it until somebody sent a couple emails. Strange, strange stories indeed. Somebody check it out for us. See what you see out there. I'm not sure it even happened, to tell you the truth. They're starting to find little emails people are sending me. Apparently, her property was raided in the form of the emails, they say, not her house. But it's still all over the internet. Strange. Judica, welcome back.
Thank you.
Let's talk a little bit about wicked witchcraft.
My favorite topic.
You're not a witch, right?
It depends how you define a witch.
Uh-huh. I knew it.
I always ask people that, how do you define a witch? Because, you know, if you think a witch is someone who desecrates cemeteries and eats babies and does terrible things to other people, then I am absolutely not a witch. I don't do any of those things. But, I certainly know how to cast a spell. I have.
And you don't hurt people.
No, I try my best.
All right, let's talk a little bit about witchcraft. First of all, what is a witch?
You know, the problem with the word witch, the word witch derives from the same roots as wise and wisdom, but we have one word in English to describe so many things. For me, a witch is a person who studies the mysteries of the world, studies the mysteries of, especially the natural mysteries, the secrets of the earth and the stars and, you know, the waters and all the mysterious powers that we have not yet been able to quantify and categorize. But there's, you know, the world is an interesting place, and there's all kinds of interesting things in it. And so, for me, a witch is a specialist in those powers and those forces. Someone who's interested in those things. I think a witch is a lot of witches have certain personality traits, and there is certainly an independent nature, independent, maybe a little anti-authoritarian.
Mm-hmm. Are they born witches?
That's hard to say. Maybe. I think if you want to be a witch, you can be.
And I'm not talking about Wiccan as a religion.
No,
I'm talking about the spell casting.
Yeah, me too. I'm not a Wiccan. Maybe. I mean, there's all kinds of theories about that. You know, when you get into theories about the Watchers, the Rebel Angels, and how people who are magical practitioners today are the descendants of those Watchers and the original women they fell in love with. And, you know, if you take a DNA test now, they can calculate how much Neanderthal ancestry you have, and maybe one day they'll be able to calculate, you know, the witch blood. I don't know if that's true or not, but that is certainly a theory.
Now, in terms of spells, and this is what's always fascinated me about this, they work, don't they?
A lot of the time, yeah. I mean, they're not nonsense. There's a reason people have been talking about this for thousands and thousands of years. Some of the earliest writings we have, you know, deal with magic spells and taxes, so, you know, things that don't go away. You'll find spells all around the world, all cultures, different styles of spell casting, but a lot of commonalities. So, they do work. I mean, people ask me all the time, what is the most dangerous thing that will happen to you if you cast a spell? And in general, the most dangerous thing is that spells work. So be careful what you ask for.
What about curses?
Oh, curses can work too.
Does the person who's cursed have to know about it?
No, and you don't have to believe in magic spells for them to work either. That's a fallacy. There's all this, well, I don't believe in it, so it won't affect me. But that's like saying, you know, I don't believe in viruses, so I won't get sick. No, you don't have to know. I mean, it is, if you recognize that you've been cursed, and cursing is not as common as people think. There are many magical and other reasons for being unlucky. It doesn't have to be a curse, but if you have been cursed and you know you've been cursed, it's easier to remove it. And it's important to remember that every spell has an antidote, so you're not stuck. Even if you think someone has hexed you, someone has cursed you, you have a long family line of curses, You're not stuck. Everything can be broken or removed. The longer it's been there, the harder it is to get off. But that's like, you know, that's like getting a dog with fleas. If you have a dog, if you catch the fleas right away, one flea bath, and you can, you know, you can nip that in the bud. But if you get this dog who's had, you know, 10 years of fleas, it's going to take some work and more than one treatment. So if you realize that you are, you know, socializing with the wrong people, you're socializing with the cursing kind of people, and you've gotten into trouble and you catch that right away, that is a lot simpler to break than, you know, I come from 10 generations of cursed people or some similar scenario.
Why would somebody want to curse somebody else to hurt them?
Two reasons. The negative reason is that there are many angry people. There are people who are frustrated and angry and jealous, and the easiest way to avoid a curse is to avoid people like that. Try not to surround yourself with people who are envious, all those toxic emotions. The other possibly less negative side is cursing is sometimes the last resort of people who feel they cannot get justice in any other way. Someone, let's say, who's the victim of a crime or has a loved one who was a victim of a crime, and that crime is unpunished and it seems as if people are getting away with it. Often the curse is the response to that.
Doesn't karma come into effect with something like this, Judica, where if you toss out something bad, something bad is going to come back to you? If you do good, something good is going to come back?
Yeah, I mean, that's the biblical reaping what you sow. I mean, that's, I think, a fact of the universe. Everybody has a bad day once in a while, and you know, I have a book called The Big Book of Practical Spells, which is a course in spell casting, and that book has no curses. And deliberately, because if you are angry enough, you don't need anybody to teach you how to cast a curse. That, you know, a certain level of rage will just sort of generate that on its own. But if you are perpetually angry, if you are perpetually frustrated, and if you're giving off, you know, these negative, you know, they're like poison arrows. Chinese metaphysics will call them poison arrows that target other individuals. You know, you'll find that energy coming back to you. You know, the example I give frequently is to test this. Take a day and be nice to everyone. Smile at everyone. Give compliments. And watch. You know, do it with strangers. Do it with, like, the checkout people in the supermarket. And watch. They'll turn happy, and they'll become nicer. And even if they're not nicer to you, keep an eye on them. They'll be nicer to the next person. And the converse of that is, take a day, you know, maybe an hour. You don't even have to do this for a whole day. And be grouchy. Be mean. Snarl.
No, I don't want to do that.
But you watch, because people's moods will change. And that is the power that we have.
They'll ignore you.
They'll get frustrated.
You'll be like a psychic vampire. They want
well,
to get away
they'll,
from
they'll
you.
Start taking it out on other people. And so, you know, that is to recognize your power. You have the power to change the mood, you know, change people's moods. You can make them generous and kind, or you can make them frustrated and mean. And, you know, kind and generous is better for everybody.
My 8-year-old grandson called me today. His name's Gavin, and he said, Papa, what do you think of me having a Ouija board, but I'll put sage all around me?
Smart
He's
kid.
8 years old.
Wow.
And I'm going, Gavin, no with the Ouija board. And I explained to him why.
Yeah.
And I think he got it.
Yeah.
But I'm saying to myself, how did he get this about sage? He's too little to listen to the show. He's, you know, he goes to bed early.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe my daughter, his mother, told him about it.
Other kids.
Or other kids.
People know sage. And, you know, there are other methods of cleansing. I actually like to vary them, because I, you know, it's like, you know, It's like the those bugs that get resistant to antibiotics, to specific antibiotics.
Oh, yeah.
I try to vary, you know. You do save sometimes, you do some frankincense another time, you know. Switch it around a little so nothing gets resistant.
So back to witches for just a bit. And again, these books are all available, aren't they?
Yeah.
For
Easily.
people who are practicing curses,
Yeah.
would you recommend that they just simply back off and not do that?
Yeah. I would. I
Because a
mean,
curse is a connotation. It's bad, isn't it? I don't, I've never
in
heard of a,
general,
I mean, a spell is good in as far as I'm concerned.
you know, what is a magic spell? A magic spell is a conscious attempt to harness magical energy to achieve a goal. And it is intended to make your life better. Spells are supposed to improve your life, not make them worse. And the problem with, if you are an angry, negative person who is just throwing out curses at other people, you're not actually improving your own life. All you're doing is spreading misery around. So, you know, you need to shake that off and become a more positive person and improve your life. I am a strong believer in living well being the best revenge.
I mean, you've written a book on spells.
I have written several books on spells, yeah.
The late good witch,
Yeah.
Evelyn Paglini,
Yeah.
always said that, you know, if you're going to do a spell, you need a certain kind of candle with a certain kind of color. What does that have to do with it?
I mean, you do. I mean, really what you need for a spell, the bottom line, real bottom line, is you need to be a human being with a fear or a desire. You need to have a goal. You need to want something. You know, more money, safety, a home, I mean, whatever, to sell your home, whatever that is, you need to have a goal. And everything else makes, you know, you can look around the world, everything you see has a magical energy. Colors, objects, sounds, fragrances, animals, other people, everything radiates a type of a magical energy. And so when you put these things together, it helps your spell work. And so candles are among the most popular methods of casting a spell. You put your desire, you hold that candle in your hand, and you focus on your goal and your desire, and as you burn it, that goal and desire that you have transmitted into the candle goes into the universe, you know, up to the powers that be, and, you know, ideally affects the change. Some of it is psychological, you know. Green is, to people in the West, green tends to be the color of money, and so a green candle is often used for a money spell. But, you know, you can always, they are really intended to make your life better. So if you can't find a green candle, you can't find a brown candle for justice, you can always use a white candle. You know, go and see what you can find. Kitchen witchcraft, where you literally look around your kitchen and see what you can find, is, you know, a really, really excellent, effective, inexpensive method of transforming your life into the life that you want, as opposed to the life you may have found yourself stuck with.
Would you call a spell a prayer?
The technical definition, the difference, they're close. They're on a spectrum. The technical definition is that a prayer is a request. We ask for something. We beseech. You know, we beseech God for something. A spell is a demand. A spell is sometimes we look at our life and this is so not where we want to be. You know, you look at your life and, oh my God, how did I get here? I can't, this cannot be my life. And a spell is sometimes putting the brakes on that And it is a little bit more forceful than a prayer. Instead of thy will be done, it's my will be done.
Amazing work, isn't it?
Yeah.
And can you use a spell for just about anything, a job, relationship, anything?
Yeah, if you can think of it. If you can think of it, there is a spell for it.
And there's meditation involved there.
Sometimes, yeah, visualizations also. I like visualizations. One of the best ways to ensure your spells work, to make it more likely that they're going to work, is to visualize the goal accomplished. In other words, don't focus on your problem. Let's say this is something for healing. You know, clearly you're not well, because if you were well, you wouldn't be doing the spell. But don't focus on the aches and pains and the illness. See yourself as you wish to be. See yourself in your head as if the spell has already worked and you're happy and you're healthy and you're bouncy and, you know, you're off doing whatever it is that you want to do. And that's easier said than done. That can be a painful thing to do. You know, if it's a love spell, see yourself loved. The whole power of positive thinking movement derives from spellcraft. It's a demystified spellcraft. And so that is, that mind over matter is a big part of this.
Judica, you have done remarkable work.
Thank you.
In all these areas that you get involved with. Now, what is your favorite of the metaphysical that you do? What's your favorite?
Oh, reading cards, always.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, that was my gateway. I came into metaphysics through divination. Samuel Weiser, going back to Samuel Weiser,
yeah.
My sister was at Cooper Union Art School. My sister's 12 years older than I am, so when I was 6, she was 18. And she brought home a deck of tarot cards from Samuel Weiser's. And I fell in love with them. And I'm still in love with them to this day. I still have the same deck.
That's great. I wish I still had my baseball cards, to tell you the truth. Tom was just pricing some of the old cards, many of which I had.
Oh, my God.
Like Mickey Mantle cards, $49,000.
Oh, my God.
Things like that. And they're gone. I had them all.
Yeah.
Oh.
If only.
But my mother doesn't know where we gave them to. She doesn't know.
But maybe one day you'll open a cupboard and they'll be there.
She called me a couple days ago, and she said, did you ever go up in the attic? Meaning her house.
Yeah.
It's a small house. But she said, did you ever go up in the attic to look for your baseball cards? And I said, no, I never put them up there. She says, yeah, but we might have.
Yeah.
Wouldn't it be cool if they were up there?
That would be wonderful.
I love it. Anyways, Judica, stay with us. We're going to come back for a final hour where we'll talk about all kinds of things metaphysical, witchcraft, and phone calls, too, on Coast to Coast AM.